This interview was recorded at Agile 2013 in Nashville, Tennessee. This audio file and others like it are available for free download at InfoQ.com.
Hi, everyone. My name's Taj Aaron. I'm an Agile editor here at InfoQ, and today I'm joined by Jeff Patton. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Good to be here.
Good to have you. So to get us started a little bit, maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Where do I start? I'll give you the intro that I give other people. I've been in software development for over 20 years now. I was lucky enough to get started on this on the ground floor of the Agile Ponzi scheme. I started with an XP project in 2000 that had hired Kent Beck to coach it, and right away I fell in love. I simultaneously fell in love with working this way and just hated it. And I loved the attention paid to process and the discipline around it, but I had come from a world where I had moved through the ranks as a developer to a UI developer to a UI designer to a product manager, and I was focused on building good products, and I saw a lot of missing practice around products. So I've been in every role in software development, but for the last chunk of years I've been working as a consultant. My area of focus is on agile practice plus good product management plus good user experience practice, and today that's a blend of lean user experience and lean startup thinking, things like that.
So where would you kind of say that agile practices kind of drop the ball on the product management side of things?
It's funny. I can remember an old mentor of mine and me trying to make the case that agile practices were really missing something, that they'd really dropped the ball. And he kept telling me that, no, that's not, it's not that they dropped the ball. That's not what agile process is for. So in defense of agile process, they do a lot of right things, but agile process, or at least the way that they're traditionally used, are focused around delivery. A traditional agile process starts with somebody who wants something describing it, a lot of emphasis on communication and how well people work together. Then we focus on using a lot of good practice for building things, and at the end of a cycle, we look at what we've built and we inspect it. But these days, I focus on good product practice where we try really hard to make sure we're building something that someone wants from the outset. See if I can more concisely answer this. Agile process is built around what might be an IT model where someone has requirements and gives them. But I work with a lot of product companies where the hardest thing is figuring out what we should build at all. And there's a lot of work we can do short of building working software isn't always the cheapest, fastest way to figure out if we should build software. And that's what's missing for me in agile practice. And what's cool to see is the evolution of this stuff. The thread of lean startup is inside the agile community and inside a lot of other places. And that's both an attention to that concern and a sensible, fast attention to that concern.
And you mentioned the word requirements. That was something you kind of talked about in your talk.
Yeah.
That stories and requirements are different.
This particular conference, I'd been asked to deliver a talk in the Agile Bootcamp track, a talk about requirements and planning and product management in Agile. And I said, I'm only going to talk about it if I can start with that Kent Beck quote that, from the Extreme Programming Explained, don't remember it exactly, but it's something to the effect of that word requirements has caused more damage to the software development industry than any other. He explains that you call things requirements, but the truth is that they're not required. The majority of requirements aren't actually required to really deliver value or benefit. And when you call things a requirement, gosh, it's been my experience, the minute you say this is a requirement, it's kind of a conversation killer. You say it's a requirement, people say then, okay, great, it's required, then just tell me the details of how it should go, and I will build it. But the idea behind user stories is the reason they're called stories is we're supposed to be talking to each other. They got their name from the idea that you and I should get together and you should tell me your story. And it's during that story you will talk about, well, paint your vision for this product or this thing or this the software functionality, who's using it and what they would do and why they're using it. And together we figure out what's the most, what's the best solution to this? What's the most cost-effective thing we could build for someone? It's a very different thinking and working style to me guessing at what I want and describing it to you as a requirement and you building it. At the end of the day, you don't understand what my real problem is, and I may understand my problem, but I'm not the software expert, and I gave you my guess at the solution. That requirements model is a bit dysfunctional, and stories try to fix it, so that's what we're trying to correct.
Okay. And you also mentioned, though, aside from not being a big fan of agile development, and that it leaves out a lot of product stuff, you also mentioned that you weren't a huge fan of epics and themes, which are commonly used.
The word story gets its name from how it's supposed to be used. You're supposed to tell me your story. Calling something an epic kind of breaks it down. I guess we mean epic as a big story, and tell me your epic no longer means something. And I too often see the word epic used. First off, the word epic refers to a story that's really big, and when we say big, we mean takes a long time to develop. Now, if we really are talking about a user's story, the story I tell is not, it's based upon what I need, not how long it takes to develop. One example I remember from a company building something, they're building a product that allows for drawing, and there's a simple menu choice where you say file, save as, Photoshop document. Sounds kind of small. I just want to save it as a Photoshop document. How big could that be? Well, as it turns out, that's something that took multiple developers months to build. That's an epic. How would I possibly know that if I was a user? So I oftentimes hear engineers say, well, that's an epic, as a way of saying to people, you haven't broken down your story small enough, and it starts to smack of you haven't broken down your requirements small enough, and it's no longer a conversation, no longer us working together. So, not a fan of the term. I didn't hit the themes, but the theme's not so bad, but theme just means a bunch of things that work together. But
you had a really good analogy there that I liked in your session. I was wondering if you could share it with us. It was how you referred to stories in relation to the game Asteroids.
I'll ask people first off to think of stories as rocks. If you take a big rock and put it on the floor and hit it with a mallet and it breaks them into a lot of pieces, what do you call those pieces? They're rocks. A rock is a rock all the way through, and stories are too. You can break them down that way. And then there's the Asteroids metaphor. Now, I got this metaphor from, I'm going to be in trouble for not mentioning his name. It'll come to me in just a minute. I can picture his face, but I can't remember his name. Sorry to him. But the old Atari game Asteroids, you're a little spaceship in the middle, and there's these big, slow-moving rocks flying through space, and your job is to shoot these big asteroids and blow them up. But if you shoot a big asteroid, it breaks down into a few faster-moving, smaller asteroids that going in every which direction. You shoot one of those, and they break down into even smaller rocks, moving even faster, going in every which direction. And it's a really crap asteroid strategy to take all your big rocks and break them down into small rocks really quickly. You'll die. And so I tell people to do that with their backlogs. Don't take all your big stories and break them down into lots of small little stories. You'll have hundreds of them and you'll die. It's a losing strategy for managing backlogs. The cool thing about stories in backlogs is you can put them back together. You can roll up lots of small stories into bigger stories, and you can't do that in asteroids. So think asteroids when you're working with backlogs.
Nice. So you also mentioned a lot about doing workshops. I guess you also touched on workshops versus grooming as
yeah.
well. So maybe you can explain
grooming
the difference.
Grooming is another word to rant about. I remember taking some original Scrum training from Ken Schwaber in the early 2000s. And I remember him using the term grooming the same way you use grooming for your beard or your hair. It means, man, you're looking shaggy or disheveled. Grooming means cut away, remove things. And grooming your backlog, back then I understood it to mean stop using your backlog as a trash can. Stop throwing any old thing in there. Cut away the stuff you don't need. Keep it tight. And for me, if leveraging that asteroids metaphor, take a lot of the little junk and roll it back up to convert lots of stories into bulleted lists. Keep it tight. Keep it orderly. That's what grooming means. But one of the things that has to happen to stories, we need to start getting clear about what our story is before we go into a planning meeting. It just makes them go better. And we need to have lots of conversations with team members about them. We need to really imagine the details of how they work, understand the business rules behind them, understand what UI would or could or should look like, and we may need to do UI design, and we eventually need to arrive at an agreement of what we'll build, the acceptance criteria stuff. So all that work to go into deeper understanding and elaborate them usually gets called backlog grooming now. A word is, there's an old Lewis Carroll quote from Alice in Wonderland that Humpty Dumpty said, when I say a word, it means precisely what I want it to mean. So grooming means precisely what its people want it to mean. So that's okay that it mean that. But now to the question you asked, the anti-pattern I see on grooming is lots of people show up in a room. We project your favorite agile lifecycle management tool, a Jira or a Rally or a version 1 at the wall, and someone mans the keyboard, and we all type in acceptance criteria. And, lots of people try and ask, type in acceptance criteria, and lots of people monkey with their smartphones under their desks. Everybody complains that it's too long, and that is not the conversation that Kent Beck imagined when he described stories. The conversations we should be having are animated, they're impassioned, they're in front of whiteboards, they're drawing words and pictures, they're discussing alternatives, they're trying to imagine what's the most cost-effective way to solve this problem. They're not these boring things. So I think what I might have said is that when a bunch of people get together and it sucks, we call that a meeting. When a bunch of people get together and work effectively together, we might call that a workshop or collaboration. So backlog grooming meetings are that sucky version. The conversation that needs to happen in stories was the one people were originally going for, the one where we worked together to try and solve problems.
So now one of the things that you're better known for that kind of helps facilitate that is story mapping.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm known for story mapping, which is another thing that I get embarrassed to take credit for. I was coined the term, and actually it's something I've been doing since 2001. I didn't coin the term. I called it something else in the early 2000s, but after calling it story mapping, it kind of took off. It's a simple concept, back to the asteroids metaphors. If you've got a big rock that you need to break down and you want to keep telling stories, if the big rock is about what somebody does, tell me what you imagine. Well, I imagine first a user opens the app and then does this, and then they do this, and they do this, and they do this. And if I tell the story and write down the steps as they do them left to right, because that's the way stories flow, first step, second step, third step, fourth step, and then I go back to the first step and I say, okay, if they were going to do this, what are the details of how that might look on screens? What about when things go wrong? What about other kind of boundary things? Or there are other concerns here. What we end up with is a simple two-dimensional model. Left to right, it tells a story. Top to bottom, it sort of breaks down or decomposes the story. I call it a story map because it has latitude and longitude, and it tells a story. And it's a really useful tool for helping to facilitate these conversations. And then the cool thing is that if you're trying to do some planning work and you've got a left-to-right flow, you know that users need to get from the beginning to the end of the flow. But the question isn't, if I've got to do a three-step process and I don't have enough time, which step do I remove? That's usually not an option. It's what you cut away are the details, maybe some of the options in every step you can avoid, things like that. So the top to bottom axis we used to prioritize, and we used to slice away things we don't need. So I'm known for that, but I didn't invent story maps. I gave it a name because I've seen other people create similar things. And there's an old definition for a pattern. If you tell somebody about a great idea and they say, wow, that's a great idea, that's not a pattern. But if you tell somebody about your great idea and they say, well, yeah, we do something like that too, that's a pattern. The story maps are a pattern. I've seen multiple people do stuff like this. And if they've got a name for it, it might have been something else. But a name is a powerful thing. Once I start to, we all call it by a common name now, we can kind of build up a community around that thinking.
So you mentioned that these kind of would happen in workshops. So who would be involved in these workshops?
It's a good question. You know, if I think back to the dysfunctional backlog grooming session, has everybody involved? That's another characteristic of a meeting, is that you are invited, and invited is that's kind of a euphemism for you have to go there. You're commanded. It's just like being invited to jury duty. You know that if you don't show up, you'll be arrested. So when you're invited to a backlog grooming session, that's not so good. But if it's a workshop, you are invited, and if you don't want to come, don't. But who should be there is someone who understands the product from a user's perspective, someone who understands how to code the product, and someone who understands how to, usually a tester, someone who's going to understand how to test this product. So I usually look for someone who's part of a product ownership team. And oftentimes when we get down to a detail level, it's either a business analyst or a user experience designer or a UI designer, an engineer and a tester. And I've heard people refer to that group as the three amigos. Those are the people that need to work together. And then, and other people who are interested. It's going to be a crap conversation if the people there don't want to be there, don't want to be talking about it. But it's also going to be a bad conversation if it's not balanced, you don't have those concerns represented. So you look oftentimes to a scrum master or coach to make sure we got the right people in the conversation so it's productive.
Right. So another thing, we talked about backlog grooming. There was also, you also commented on the term sprint zero as well. How does that kind of...
Yeah, I can remember Ken Schwaber once saying that, one of the creators of Scrum, that the sprint zero term, there's no such thing, and there's not a thing. The reason I don't like the term is sort of it implies that there's a sprint zero, and then I start building. It sort of implies a phase kind of thinking, that first thing I do is a big requirements thing, and then phase two is building. I'll use the term product discovery. I borrow the term's been used by a lot of other people. I follow a lot of practice and thinking from a guy named Marty Kagan, who's written a book called Inspired. It's one of the best book on product management, software product management, that's out there right now. Discovery is the work we do to figure out if we're building the right thing, to figure out what problems are we solving, what's a valuable solution, what can people use, and what's feasible to build given the tools and time that we've got. Discovery is a continuous activity that runs in parallel with delivery work. And yeah, it has to run ahead a little bit, but sometimes the work that kicks out of discovery is to build a high-fidelity prototype, to build something that we might A-B test or split test in our environment or other things like that. And so sometimes the discovery is not done and we're putting things into sprints. And the minute you ship something, you start learning things and discovery starts again. So discovery runs continuously and delivery runs continuously, and that gets referred to as dual track development is the term that gets used for that. So yeah, don't like the term sprint zero, like the term discovery, and they're both, discovery and delivery are continuous activities.
So yeah, when you mention discovery, I mean a lot of people react from more traditional, say, well, we had a whole discovery phase. So, but that's not the kind of discovery you're talking about. You're talking about it goes along with it. So how does that actually work with the team? Is the whole team doing both during a sprint, or how does that actually work in practice?
Yeah, let's see if it, hate answering questions with it depends. No, the whole team isn't doing both. Partly because, part of the reason I just said during a story workshop you don't want the whole team there, that there's some sort of natural size limitations to effective collaboration. You don't pair a program with a whole team. It takes a pair. At most, three people can sit together at a computer, and too many more than that is just too much. Nothing happens. When you're working together to do something collaborative, I put to move fast, to make decisions fast, 3 to 5 people is the most. Discovery work is usually led by a product owner or product manager, same person, by someone who understands users, that's a business an analyst in an IT context, an interaction designer, a UX person in more of a product-y context, and a lead engineer. These people steer discovery, and discovery involves business stakeholders, involves lots of users. It may involve the whole team at times, but it's usually that smaller group that steers it and pulls in people as needed. Now, I've worked with organizations where the whole team is 5 people, product owner, UX person, 2 developers, and a tester. And it seems it's dumb to pull off 3 people and leave 1 developer and 1 tester to do other stuff. So the whole team does go through discovery together. And you see kind of these ebbs and flows where this sprint we're doing a lot of discovery and not so much delivery. And then we're really confident we're building the right thing. So in subsequent sprints, we're focused a lot more on delivery and a little less discovery. And then with bigger teams, I might see a continuous thread of discovery and a continuous kind of high-volume thread of delivery with people jumping back and forth between.
So it wouldn't be so much like a separate discovery team or always the same
three. It better not be a separate discovery team. The people doing discovery have to be there to watch this thing be delivered. The engineer, the lead engineer that's helping with discovery actually isn't helping with discovery full time. They're helping with discovery some fraction of their time, and the other fraction of their time they're working on the team delivering, building things. It's a bad idea to have one group of work figure out things. In the presentation yesterday, I used a lot of the term shared understanding, that the problem with requirements documents is that you only get so much out of them. People read them and interpret different things. What happens from conversation and other things is we build a shared understanding or a mental model. We make the mistake of believing we can write it down in a documentation and people will get the same mental model. The team that does discovery may have a really clear picture in their heads, but if they hand it off to another group that does not have that clear mental picture, stuff goes wrong. And anybody who's been in software development long enough knows that even if you build very high fidelity mock-ups. Even if you build a good functional prototype, that when you actually put it in code, something weird always goes wrong. It never quite turns out the way it should. So the people who did the discovery have to be there to help massage it back into a shape that feels like it would work. Did I get there to the answer to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. One other thing you kind of touched on was kind of a shift for development teams. That's a shift from outputs to outcomes.
So over and over I draw. I've heard the language used a lot, and it was years ago at a conference, a speaker talked about the difference between output and outcome. Output is what you build, and outcome is what happens when things come out. That's why it's called that. If I build a piece of software, it's not the software that I want. It's people to use it, more people to buy it or people to use it, and for those people to use it and be happier than they were before. You measure output in terms of how much you built, and in Agile, that's how many story points you delivered and your velocity. You measure outcome using metrics or KPIs like conversion rate on a website, how many more people buy or how many more people register, how many more people like it on Facebook, how much they buy, how much they put in shopping carts. All those things you measure are actions that people are taking. Outcome is that. That's the real benefit. And so much if you're focused on requirements and details, you're paying attention to the output, not the outcome. And we want everybody to start to... Yeah, maybe one more rant. I hate the term product owner sometimes. I wish it was product leader, but that doesn't ring true. I want to see everybody in the team take ownership of how well this product is doing. And not just ownership, real pride in it doing well. You hope the person who's the product owner is a strong leader and helps set direction and vision. But if everybody's focused on outcome, that's a side effect of everybody taking ownership.
Definitely. One thing, you mentioned lean startup a little bit earlier. Yeah. And you also, in your talk, mentioned minimum viable product. Now, there's a bit of a difference between how you refer to minimum viable product and, say, Eric Ries refers to minimum viable product.
Yeah, you're talking about the talk I gave yesterday. I had to cut away a lot on the fly. there are two definitions of minimal viable product, as there are with most words in the dictionary, so don't get confused by that. I guarantee you that if you look up almost any common word in the dictionary, you're going to find 1, 2, 3, and 4 definitions for it. Hey, the original term minimal viable product came out of product management. And in fact, it was Eric Ries that a lot of his ideas were driven by Steve Blank in his book, 4 Steps to Epiphany. And even Steve Blank described minimal viable product in his book as the smallest product we could ship that is viable in the marketplace. Viable doesn't mean crappiest product I could ship. Viable for a product means, viable for a living organism means you can put it into the wild and it won't die. Viable for a product means you can put it into the market and it won't die. So the minimal viable product is not crappy. It's the good one for the target market that we've got. So that was the original definition. But Eric Ries and in Lean Startup, and the book sold so many copies, and now in the software community, his term, he redefined not minimal viable product, but he redefined it to mean an experiment. Your product are experiments. We build as many experiments as we can, and you build the smallest thing you could build to learn something. And that the smallest thing might be a landing page. That smallest thing might be a paper prototype or some other prototype. But at the end of the day, you've got to make it clear here, we're not in the experiment building business. We're building experiments so that we can figure out what the product is. So you build minimal viable product experiments so that you can learn what the minimal viable product in the marketplace is. So I'll define MVPEs as the thing we build to figure out what MVP is.
Okay. One of the other things you kind of touched on a bit was a little bit of, I guess, on mindset, that how people look at changes in the product,
yeah.
whether it be scope creep or whether it be learning.
Yeah, there's a lot of a legacy or holdover. We just were at this conference, and an old guy that's been around a long time, Tim Lister, spoke, and he said something pithy, funny, that test is the phase that we go into that that kicks us back to those other phases that we thought we were done with. In traditional process thinking, when we start testing something or evaluating something, and we decide it should be different, well, in traditional product thinking, where we're concerned, in traditional project-ject thinking, it's another thing I mentioned, that projects end when we deliver, products' lives start when we deliver. In traditional project thinking, anything that delays delivery is bad. And if we build something and we realize it's wrong, that's bad, and that's referred to as bad requirements or as scope creep or other sorts of derogatory terms. But in agile development, well, it should be called learning. That's what it is. As a consequence of building it, we've learned that that's not going to work. And the truth is, everything we build in software, we're manifesting ideas that are intangible. Software's not tangible anyway. We're imagining it. We might dial up our imagination with prototypes and actually make it really feel like it's right. But until we start using it and working with it and actually solving problems with it, we can't be sure it's right. And correcting our bad imagination, that's what comes out of the learning thing.
All right. And just kind of wrap us up a bit here. So what's exciting for you these days? What are you working on?
What I'm working on is, list a couple things here. I'm looking at trying to move past Agile. I'm trying to look at moving, I don't know what a next thing is going to be called, but I know it ends up having to be a blend of the good, sensible things that are in Agile. I want to jettison some of the bad thinking that's in Agile. The product owner decides what to build, and the team builds what they're told to. No, I want everyone to own. And I'm looking at processes that blend Agile with design thinking, with good user experience thinking, with lean startup thinking, and with good, solid product thinking. Trying to build a group of people that do that and build common language around that. And you grabbed me just after I finished a demo of a little tool that myself and David Hussman of DevJam are working on. I'm a tool hater. I don't like a lot of the tools out there because one of the things I get concerned about is collaboration. So we've been building a little product called Cardboard. It's a virtual board that you put cards on. That's all. That's it. If I'd love to work at people on a wall with sticky notes or a tabletop with cards, but if you and I are separated by dozens, tens, hundreds, thousands of miles, we can't do that. So this is the way we describe it is if Google Docs and sticky notes had a child, this would be it. So our emphasis is on just simple card modeling remotely. So and the thing that makes me excited is it actually is starting. More important to me isn't the list of features, is that when I'm sitting working with somebody, it feels like I'm working with them face to face, and it's starting to feel like that. So,
excellent. Well, thank you for joining us, Jeff.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here as always.